Okay, welcome. Part three, our Chazak Hashir. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Malka Simkowitz. A very quick introduction, that the Crown Writer Chair of Jewish Studies, Director of Catholic Jewish Studies Program at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. She's spoken a number of times for us. Always a pleasure to have her. Always interesting and illuminating. So, Bakashat, Dr. Malka, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your organizing this important event. And thank you to everybody making the time on this Sunday before Rosh Hashanah, a very, very busy time of year. At the beginning of the summer, which seems like yesterday, I gave a talk for Torah in Motion on objects of love in early Judaism. And if you were on that call, if you saw it on YouTube, you might remember that I started by suggesting that in the Torah, God is the primary object of love. The primary love relationship is the relationship between the people of Israel and God, and the people of Israel are given maybe one of the hardest commandments of all in the Torah, which is the commandment to love God, not only to fear God, which was an unusual expectation in the ancient Near East, to love a deity, to have an intimacy with the God, the one true God. And so the central love relationship is this relationship between God and Israel. Today, I'm going to look very briefly at the other side of the coin, not what happens when you fall into love, but what happens when you fall out of love? What happens when you fall out of love with the object of love that is the center of your religious life? And now it is incumbent upon you to reconcile the broken relationship and to fix this breach, to bridge the gap and attain intimacy and reconciliation. So really the question for the next 28 and a half minutes is, when you sin, how do you atone? How do you fix this brokenness? Many of us today in the observant Jewish community think about atonement as being divisible into two distinct categories: the interpersonal, the Bein Adam Chaveiro, and all of the sort of often individual, but can also be communal, this relationship between someone and God, Bein Adam LeMakom. These are considered to be two distinct categories, and teshuvah either has to be one or the other. But this notion that we're dealing with two categories, two relationships, Bein Adam LeMakom and Bein Adam LeChaveiro, is really a rabbinic idea. And in the Torah, if you are guilty of any kind of sin, whether you might call it a ritual violation or an ethical sin, this produces a breach between you and God. And the primary job that you have is to reconcile that breach. So it doesn't matter whether it's ethical or ritual, and the Torah makes no distinctions between these two categories. A brief look at Vayikra, and especially Vayikra Yudtet, we'll see that there's really no distinction, you'll see very clearly, between the ritual and the ethical. It could be that these categories are more recognized as distinct in the rabbinic period because of early Christian thinking that sort of ritual is useless and we only care about the ethical aspects of the scriptural tradition, but that's for another talk. If in the Torah, the paradigmatic relationship, the most important relationship, is the relationship between Israel and God, and if in the Torah, love is really all about God, we have to love God because God loves us, therefore, it's only natural that atonement is really God-centered. Atonement is the reconciliation between two love partners, God and Israel. But as I pointed out in May or June, whenever I gave my last Torah Motion talk, just as love becomes an interpersonal category in the Second Temple period, so that Jews start to think about relationships between themselves and other people as a distinct category, so too does atonement become interpersonal in the Second Temple period. So in the Second Temple period, we move from focusing on the experiences and the emotions of God to the experiences and the and emotions of human relationships. And so atonement over time begins to take on internalized emotional dimensions. And I'm going to very briefly trace how this happens by suggesting that there are four stages of how early Jews understand atonement, beginning with the early Israelite period. And so in the earliest stages, and I will share my screen soon, in the earliest stages, We focus completely on appeasing God and reconciling a breach that has been produced. Atonement is all about encountering God and satisfying God. There isn't so much of an emotional dimension. But beginning in the first temple period in Bayit Rishon, we begin to see a heightened focus on God's emotions and desires when it comes to God's relationship with Israel. And so if you read prophetic literature, if you read Yeshayahu, and we don't have to go into how we're dating the different parts of Yeshayahu, it almost doesn't matter for my purposes, or if you read Yirmiyahu or really any of the prophets, you see an exploration of the emotional dimensions of God's internal world. Now, something very interesting happens in the Babylonian exile, which takes place from around 586 to 538 BCE. And what happens is that the Judeans who return back from exile begin to transfer discourse, emotional discourse about God to themselves. So whereas prophets in the late First Temple period are talking about God's emotions and desires and almost a desperation for an intimacy with the people of Israel, Judeans in the early Second Temple period begin to focus on their own emotions. And these emotions are really paradoxical. On the one hand, they feel extraordinary joy upon returning to the land or having this permission from Cyrus, the Persian king, to return to the land of Israel. Most of them don't. But they have this joyous experience. And also they feel extraordinary shame. They feel shame because they're not sure if the exile is over. Most Judeans, as I said, do not return to the land, and something has changed in their relationship between God and themselves, and that relationship never really returns to what it once was. And we have all kinds of rabbinic traditions about how the Second Temple was inferior to the First Temple. And so there's paradoxical emotions. And this exploration of the internal emotions of the people vis-a-vis God develops over the Second Temple period, as they begin to explore interpersonal relationships and how these relationships impact their connection to God. And so by the early rabbinic period, we have another stage where the rabbis separate out atonement and reconciliation into two categories, one between people and one between God, God and Israel. And so again, I see four stages of how early Jews understand atonement. And I'm going to share my screen, so it'll be easier when you see the source sheet. But again, those four stages are the early Israelite period, where atonement is about satisfying God because there has been a breach, whether that breach is an ethical or a ritual violation, there's been a breach. So that's stage one. Stage two is by the late First Temple period, there is a heightened focus on the internal emotional a world of God and God's desires. So the prophets speak less about the people's emotional desires and they focus much more on God's emotions. And the third stage is after the exile, after Galut, where the people begin to speak about atonement as an experience, an emotional experience that they are having. And that is a very conflicting process as they seek to reconcile this broken relationship. That's stage three. And stage four is as the Jewish people over the Second Temple period begin to explore their own emotional relationships and sort of do so outside of their relationship with God, we have two categories develop. And those are the categories of Bein Adam LeMakom and Bein Adam LeChavero. Now, this actually ends up going full circle because by the second or third century CE, the rabbis once again say, if you fall out of favor with a friend, you cannot be in favor with God. So it's sort of returning back to that biblical model that you cannot be in right relationship with God unless you reconcile all your interpersonal relationships. So now in about 15 minutes, I'm going to share some sources with you. And whatever I don't get to, hopefully you'll have some time to do on your own. Let me see if I can share. For some reason, I'm unable to share Wait, I think I can. Do you see the PDF? You see? Oh, okay, perfect. The Emotions of Atonement in Early Judaism. So here I have some psukim from Vayikra that talks about atoning in the context of a ritual process. Atonement is a physical process that rectifies the relationship with God. There isn't so much in terms of the emotional component of God. It's not about guilt, as many of my Catholics think. It's not about a feeling of shame. It's simply about a breach that has to be reconciled, because when you approach the God of perfection, the God of wholeness, you too, as Jacob Milgram and Mary Douglas have shown, you need to approach the perfect God of life in a way that separates you from forces of death. But there really isn't an aspect here of feeling bad, of feeling shame, of feeling guilt. You did something wrong. You are now separate from God. You want to be intimate with God? You have to fix it. So it's not about guilt. It's not about shame. This does change as we enter into the First Temple period by Rishon. Now, what I'm really going to spend the next few minutes on, actually the rest of this little mini talk on, is I am going to compare two speeches in Tanakh. One happens at the very, very beginning of the First Temple period, and that is Shlomo's speech when he dedicates the temple. And he talks about the function of the temple as a place where you atone. And I'm going to compare that with a famous speech that happens at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. It's actually not really the Second Temple period yet, but it's just before. And that is a speech that Ezra and the people give at the moment that they are returning back to the land of Israel. And we have that speech in Nehemiah, Perek Tet. So these two speeches are very, very, very similar. But Shlomo's speech does not have a developed emotional component. It's really pragmatic. And so if you look at Shlomo's speech, this is the dedication ceremony for the temple that he has just built in Jerusalem. I wish we could spend a lot of time on it, but we're just going to skim through it. You'll see that, again, this is a very pragmatic speech about the kinds of sins that one might commit and the ways in which a person, what kind of sacrifice a person can bring to atone for that sin. So it's very, very pragmatic. And now I just brought in Yeshayahu to show that over the course, again, I'm not going to date Yeshayahu here, but over the course of the First Temple period, we have this growing exploration of God's internal turbulence when the people abandon the covenantal relationship. And so there's very emotional relationship, very emotional language in Yeshayahu, but it's focused on God's internal world. But let's compare. This is really what I'm interested in for today. Let's compare Nehemiah, the moment at which the Judeans are returning to the land of Israel and they're building the walls around Jerusalem and they're about to build the second temple. And you have a very comparable, very parallel situation between the moment that Shlomo dedicates the temple and the moment that Nehemiah and Ezra are gathering the people in Jerusalem to begin the process of building and dedicating the second temple. And the function of the second temple is really a way for the Jews to channel their emotions and rather than feeling shame and sadness, to feel joy and relief. So let's look at some of these emotional differences over here. And if you have a Tanakh, I would encourage you to open that up because I don't have all of this on the source sheet. But also if you want to scroll up and down, then use the link that was in the chat box. Okay, so if you were to do a real deep dive comparing these speeches, you would see actually extraordinary parallels between Melachim Aleph Perchet and Nehemiah Perchet. In both stories, this is not just about establishing Jerusalem and its temple as the center of the Jews' religious life or the Judeans' religious life, but there are real details here that are very, very parallel. In both stories, a Judean leader assembles the people at the site of the temple following an elaborate display of the community's wealth and the significance of emphasizing the treasury and the opulence of the kingdom is the same in both stories. By publicly displaying its riches, you have a leader, whether it's Shlomo or whether it's Ezra and Nehemiah, assuring the people that they will successfully establish an autonomous, powerful community dedicated to cultivating the relationship between the people and God. And in both stories, the people gather around a public exhibition of a physical object that signifies God's covenant with the people of Israel that was established at Sinai. So Malachim Av Perchet, this object is the Ark. And Nechemiah Perchet, this object is a Torah scroll that Ezra gathers the people and they ask him, read from a Torah scroll. And that is what he does. And again, you'll see they're very emotional. They respond with tears. They respond with crying. They realize that they have not been properly observing God's law in exile. Following this, the leaders recite a blessing that highlights God's omnipotence, and the language of this blessing is very similar. In both stories, we have language relating to the earth and the sky and the universality of God's dominion, so you can look that up on your own. Both texts do express contrition for Israel's sins. Both texts ask God to provide the people with a means to absolve them of their sins. And so a superficial reading of Malachim Aleph Perchet and Nehemiah Perchet might indicate to you that these stories are really parallel and they're the same. And the kind of public atonement that you had in the early First Temple period was identical to the kind of atonement that you had in the early Second Temple period. And again, there's all kinds of literary parallels. Both speeches highlight the word Shema because they're asking God to hear their prayers. Both have the word Eved, we are your servants, God, and highlight the sort of vulnerability that the people have. They really are dependent on God for forgiveness because their imperfections are too overwhelming to sort of resolve. And yet, there are key differences between these speeches. And really, the differences, as you can guess, have to do with the emotional experience of the people. The Israelites in Malachim Aleph Perchet are passive witnesses to a politically significant event overseen by their king, who gives a rousing speech but doesn't recite scriptural passages and doesn't involve them. They're witnesses to Shlomo's speech. But in Nehemiah Chet, the people gather of their own volition. They take initiative. They ask Ezra to read the Torah to them. And he does, and they cry. They're hysterical. So over and over, Nehemiah says, do not cry. Here, I can scroll down a little bit and you can, I don't have all of this. Again, I don't have the whole thing here, but you could see he's saying, Al Tita Blue, when I highlight, you see that, right? When I highlight? Okay, I'll assume yes. All right, thank you, Jay. Al Tita Blue, Al Tipchu, Kibochim, Kola Am, Kishom Am, Etzivrei HaTorah. They're crying, they're sobbing because they recognize that they have not been properly observing their ancestral traditions. They're responding emotionally. And again, the Israelites who hear Shlomo's speech, they take no action. They do say amen to his blessing, but that's pretty much about it. Joyful emotions are mentioned in both stories. You do have a reference to the day of Shlomo's dedication being a celebratory, joyous day, but it's only in Nehemiah Chet where the people's happiness is presented as a deeply personal and collective experience. And so I want to suggest that the event of exile is an absolute turning point for how the people view their relationship with God. It's not merely about, oh, you sinned. It doesn't matter if it's an ethical sin or a ritual sin, but now you're out of favor with God. You need to fix it, bring a sacrifice. Now the people who've been in exile have experienced the trauma of isolation, of physical and spiritual isolation from God. They are familiar with the oral traditions from the prophets that describe God's desperate longing, this emotional longing for the people, and they internalize that, turn the mirror onto themselves and say, we too feel that longing. We too feel joy when we are intimate with our God, and we too feel desperate sadness when we are not near our God. And so we have these very emotional scenes. We have a confession in Nehemiah Perek Tet, which is this beautiful speech that I think many of us don't know about, because how many of us are reading Nehemiah Perek Tet? Maybe all of you are, but I don't know that I that I was particularly familiar with this until my graduate work. But in any case, so Nehemiah Perek Tet has this very extensive confession speech, which I'm not going to go through, but basically it reviews Israel's early history, the pattern of God saving the people of Israel, despite the fact that they do not deserve God's salvation. And it goes on and on and on. The people delight in your great goodness. I underline that because looking back on early Israelite history, Ezra sort of superimposes this emotional experience onto the early Israelite period But coming from this context where they've just left the trauma of exile, they're seeing it through an emotional lens. Now, as we go into the Second Temple period, we also develop not only positive emotions when it comes to God and when it comes to others, but also, again, the emotion of shame when Daniel, and I also cite for you the book of Baruch, which is preserved in the Apocrypha, but these are texts that are produced in the early Second Temple period. Well, Baruch might be later, but certainly Daniel is looking back on the experience of exile, and he's describing the exile as an experience of shame. And how do you reconcile this broken relationship with God? You name your feelings, right? It's not just that, okay, God, we have to do teshuva. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. We're going to bring a sacrifice and now we're all good. But we name the feelings of despair and longing that God, through the mouths of the prophets, had once named as the people moved towards exile. And so now they're speaking about their own shame. Baruch uses language from Daniel. Again, shame, very interesting emotion. I don't know that we see, although I'd be interested if someone can correct me, because her emotion always has the best audience members. And maybe somebody knows of an earlier biblical text that talks about the people's shame. I can't think of one, but I do think it's a very important experience or a central emotion that is associated with exile as we move through the Second Temple period. And now with my very little time left, I will just say that under, and this is not really on the source sheet, but under the influence of Hellenism, Jewish writers begin to explore their emotional worlds in a more developed way, not only in relation to how they connect with God, but also in relation to one another. And so it becomes a Jewish value to love your neighbor. I mean, obviously we have that in Vayikra, but it becomes extremely highlighted in Jewish Hellenistic literature to feel empathy for the stranger and all these things. And as I've said in earlier Torah motion classes, a lot of this has to do with the fact that the Jews are being accused of misanthropy and being insular. And so under Hellenistic influence, Jewish writers are highlighting how important it is to feel feelings towards others, not simply to treat them in the proper way with the proper action, but to feel a love for one another. Now, in the rabbinic period, and here I'll end, maybe we'll have time for a couple comments or questions, but I've not looked at the chat. So I see that people have commented, but I haven't looked yet. But in the rabbinic period, we have the explicit statement, and again, this goes back full circle to the biblical sources, that you cannot treat the relationship that's interpersonal and the relationship with God as distinct and unrelated categories. That is what is happening in the late Second Temple period as Jews are using emotional language to talk about one another and to talk about God. But the rabbis make it very clear, yes, these are two separate categories, but if you want to be in right relationship with God, you must reconcile on an emotional level with those whom you have wronged. So it's not enough to pay someone back the proper amount if you steal from them, but you need to make sure that that person is in the right emotional state. And so we have the source in Yoma that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah taught, from the source, Mikol Chatotechem Lifnei Hashem Titaru, from all your sins you shall be cleansed before the Lord. Yes, for transgressions between a person and God, Yom Kippur does atone, but for transgressions between a person and another, Yom Kippur does not atone until Ad Sheyiretze Et Chavero, until the person who sinned against another person reaches out to that person who has been wronged and makes sure that they are in the correct emotional state, that they emotionally forgive them. Now, the other side of the coin is that it is incumbent upon the person who is wronged to forgive the person. So we have a source in Bava Kamma that, yes, you are required to request forgiveness from a victim, but likewise, the person who is asked forgiveness is expected to grant that forgiveness. And so, wrapping up, I cannot believe that I gave this shiur in 25 minutes. I spoke very fast. Just to sort of wrap this all up again, The evolution of ancient Jewish understandings of atonement is a process by which early Israelites go from viewing atonement as a cultic ritual that is a necessary part of the people's relationship with God to an internalized individual experience that highlights one's emotional attitude towards God and towards other people. And the rabbis make it clear that if you want to be in right relationship with God, you have to attend to the emotional aspects of your interpersonal relationships. And so the rabbis accept the biblical notion that interpersonal sins impact one's relationship with God. They build on earlier Jewish sources to make it possible for atonement to build in the, to take place in the absence of a temple, but they recognize something that is not totally developed in Vayikra and in early biblical literature, and that is that atonement always, always has to have an emotional component, whether you are talking about reconciling a relationship that you have in a private way with God or in terms of your interpersonal relationships. If you don't have that emotional component, you have not completed the process of atonement. And so now maybe we can...
Malta, yes. Isn't the hit bada in Vayikra an expression of guilt?
I don't know if it is. I'm not convinced that it is. Hit bada. I mean, what? So it's not developed. It's not defined.
Acknowledge.
We say it is.
Acknowledge. That's what it means.
Right. So I don't know if that's developed. Is that, first of all, it's not guilt or shame in the way that maybe Christians think it might be. So that feeling of like a real sadness, of real, you know, shame, we see that throughout Second Temple literature. We don't see that, I don't think, in the biblical sources.
The vidui. What is the vidui then?
Well, I think that in the rabbinic understanding of vidui, you have this extremely powerful emotional experience. I don't know that that's innate to the biblical tradition.
Thank you.
And there is actually, I know I have to stop. There is, there are Second Temple texts of confession that precede what we know as the vidui. So you have in Qumran and you have in other liturgical texts that are very early, is equivalent to a vidui in terms of being very, very emotional. So I would say from second century BC and on. Thank you very much and have a Shana Tova.
You have an extra minute if you want. You know, we started you a minute late, so if you want to. But thank you very much. As Malka notes, anybody who prepares a shiur know it's harder to give a shiur in 30 minutes than in 60 minutes. And to give, you know, that's, but thank you very much, really.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes. And I will say, I just see in the comment, yes, Ezra 9, I don't know if I put that on the source sheet. But in any case, you have the source sheet, and that is a late text, Ezra 9, Second Temple, right? Or, you know, post-exilic text. So I think that supports what I was saying. Feel free anytime to send me an email at msimkovich@ctu.edu. And I wish you all well. And I hope that you have a period of emotional atonement in all of your relationships and a fulfilling and meaningful Rosh Hashanah. Take care.
Shana Tova.
Thank you.
That was fantastic, Malka.
That's so awesome.